The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We are going to begin the third chapter of Rav Kook's book called The Light of Repentance. Last time we got together, we talked about sudden and gradual repentance. Sometimes you have to know when to let it happen, and sometimes you need to know when to make it happen. Today, we're going to talk about two modes of tshuva, and it's all interconnected. One he calls particularized tshuva, and another one he calls general tshuva. And we'll see how far we can get. It's a lot, but it's absolutely critical. So let's read. There is a form of penitence. It's up on the right-hand side of your page. There's a form of penitence that addresses itself to a particular sin or to many particular sins. In other words, I know I did this sin. I spoke Lashon Hara, I spoke slanderously, that's my sin, right? I know I ripped this guy off, oh, that's my sin. That's a particular, I go point by point, I know what it is, and I deal with it. And that is called, he's calling, a particular repentance. The person, now he's going to tell us, how do you do that? Okay? We know what the situation is. We're dealing with particular sins that we can focus on, we can locate, we can identify, isolate. This is what I'm working on. Good. What do I have to do? The person confronts his sin face to face. Now that's a mouthful, right? To confront your sin face to face. Now, there's a basic format for tshuva in Judaism. The first step is called hakarat achet, which is to recognize the sin. The second step is charata, which means to be remorseful, to be regretful of it. And then the third step is azivat hachet v'kabalat la'atid, which is to leave the sin and to accept upon myself that I, in fact, will not do this again. That's what you got to do. Okay, so the first thing is called hakarat hachet. The other thing is charata, which means to hakarat lahakir, means to recognize the sin. Lahakir, okay? So it's to recognize the sin. Charata means to regret. And then the last thing is called aziva, which means to leave it. I regret it and I leave it, and then I accept towards the future that I will not do it again. That's standard. I mean, everybody knows this. The Rambam talks about it. And it's not like Rav Kook is saying anything really new, but what Rav Kook is doing is giving us a much deeper appreciation of what this means to recognize the sin. I mean, to recognize the sin, does that mean, yup, that's it, I did it. Yeah, that's it. I spoke Lashon Hara, I spoke slanderously, yeah, that's it. Okay, now feel bad about that. Okay, I won't do it. Oh, no. We're talking about a real metamorphosis of consciousness. And the first step is to face the sin. Not just like, oh yeah, I spoke slanderously. What does it mean to face it? To confront his sin face to face. That's what it means to recognize. So Rav Kook is giving us a commentary on something that's quite known, but is, I think, not enough appreciated. To confront the sin means to recognize that we are generally in a state of denial. Okay? We're in a state of denial. How so? Okay, yes, I've got this list. Yom Kippur, you'll see in your machzor. You have a list of all these sins that you did, right, or could have done. And you know, when you go and you knock yourself, you say, and on this sin, on that sin, on this sin, on that sin, you got this whole shopping list of sins. Does that mean I recognize the sin? Face to face, I face up to what I did. So let's think about it. So if we take the example of Lashon Hara, right? I spoke slanderously. What did I really do? Let's think about what I really did. Alright? Okay, what I did is Lashon Hara. Okay? I want you to take a minute or two, and I want you to write down. I'm sure some people here have fallen into the trap of speaking slanderously and, or let's say, not nicely about another person, to another person. I want you to take this, and I'd like you to take a minute or two and write down, what did you really do? Okay? What did you really do? Okay, I spoke slanderously. Is that all I did? Right? Well, what about, I hurt that person? Oh, that's more than that. What about, I violated my abilities for speech? What about, see, I want to get to know this sin. Because there's so much more. So I have to face it face to face and totally recognize what it is. Because if I don't really recognize what it is that I did, I'm not going to feel so bad about it. Right? And so I want you to take a minute or two to write on a piece of paper, okay? And let's take the example of Lashon Hara. And really deeply recognize what in fact I really did. What I wanted to point out in a simple way is what it means to really face up to your sin and not be in a state of denial. Because we really are in a state of denial. Why are we in a state of denial? I mean, okay, so we get a Yom Kippur, we hit ourselves, I hit myself lightly on my chest over here by my heart, and say, oh, I did this, I did that. Yeah, but if I don't really get to know what is it that I really did, then there's no way I can get to the next step. And so there's a certain partial state of denial, even if I can say I did this, but what exactly is this? And why is there in fact denial in the first place? Why do I not really want to get to know my sin? I don't want to get to know my sin because I feel rotten about it. And the more I realize what it really is, and how I could have done such a thing, the more it hurts. But that's the whole point. It should hurt. Because if it doesn't hurt, then why would I stop myself from doing it again? It should hurt. It's good that it hurts. It's very healthy that it hurts. And so it's a pain that turns out to be an absolute necessary pain. I don't want to have the pain. But that's denial. You know, that's denial. It's like Jung once said that neurosis is a substitute for legitimate suffering, right? In other words, there's really a legitimate suffering that you should be suffering. And you are not allowing yourself this suffering. And therefore, if you don't allow yourself this suffering, you will express it in some neurotic way, through some neurosis, okay? So the first step is not simply, you know, recognize your sin, but really recognize your sin. Face to face. The second step is, and feel remorseful that he fell into the trap of sin. Now this is very interesting. What am I going to feel remorseful about? The sin? No. I'm going to feel remorseful about the fact that I fell into the trap of sin. Now this is very interesting. Because as Shalvi pointed out the other day, well, there are certain things that I did in the past which is kind of hard for me to really feel bad about because there's so much growth that in fact I achieved by virtue of the fact that I did something like that. And so, how's it possible to feel always bad about the sin? What I think Rav Kook is telling us over here is that I feel remorseful regarding the fall. Look, if it happened, it happened. And now I'm going to have to recycle it. Now I'm going to have to fix it. But what I'm remorseful about is not what happened, but that I let myself do that. That I wasn't enough in control. I didn't have enough awareness. I didn't have enough sensitivity, clarity, patience, balance, whatever it is, to keep myself in control and in discipline not to do this. And that's what really hurts. Because what I really did is I violated my inner freedom to be who I know I could be. And that should really hurt. And so that's what I have to get in touch with. What did I really do? I didn't just do this act. but I violated myself. I raped myself, you might say, that strongly. Because I was so unfair to myself. I was so weak with myself. I so lacked respect for myself that I could allow myself to fall to this kind of behavior and to say these kinds of things and to think these kinds of ways. And that's what really hurts me, right? Now the fact that it happened, okay? And that hurts also, but why does that hurt? I got to get in touch with what is it about it that should be hurting me? Because there's certain things about it that you'll soon see which really are a source of pleasure. Okay? But what is the source of pain over here? It's really this rip-off. I ripped myself off. I shortchanged myself. And that's a much deeper thing. And so look what he says. He says, feel remorseful that he fell into the trap of sin. How could I have fallen for this? And that's really where the pain would come. Because when it was an affront to myself. Okay? Because if you're thinking in terms of punishment, oh God will punish me. So I'm remorseful because I think I should be remorseful because I think if I'm remorseful, God won't punish me. Not the deepest approach. Right? And not really getting to the source of what's wrong and what hurts and what should be the motivation for me to change. And so he says very clearly, feel remorseful that he fell into the trap of sin. Now that itself is interesting, to call it the trap of sin. Not fell into sin, but the trap of sin. What hurts when I feel I allow myself to be trapped? It means I had a sense that, look, there are traps, right? There are pitfalls in life. And if I was just simply careful, had my eyes open, I wouldn't have done it. It's a trap. And sin is seen as something that is trapping me. Now, there's a lot to be said about that, but I don't want to do that right now. The next step is, I first confront it. I don't deny it. I don't deny any part of it. And therefore, I have to have the guts and the courage to fully, fully introspect into what really I did. When I get to that point, it'll start to hurt. And until it starts to hurt, you haven't come to know it yet. Because when you get to know it, it'll hurt. And you simply haven't gotten to know it yet. When you get to know it, it starts to hurt. And you really feel remorseful of what you did to yourself. And then what happens? Slowly he struggles to come out of it. Now the English translation, I feel, missed something very important. Because Rav Kook said very clearly, and his soul climbs and ascends out of it. His soul climbs and ascends out of it. Before he was saying, you do it, or he does it, now all of a sudden, once he has come to such a recognition and such a sense of the pain of the fall, then the soul begins to climb. And what do you mean? Why the soul begins to climb? Because it's the soul within us that is that deep-seated internal self-respect. Self-respect. And the pain just opens that up and allows it to make its way out. It's almost as if he's describing that this is natural. Once you've hit the pain, once you know how much it hurts, at that point it's as if you've opened up something inside yourself whereby your soul, which was always seeking to ascend, begins to ascend. And so what Rav Kook has accomplished here for us is I think, a much more feeling sense of tshuva. He continues, until he is liberated from his sinful enslavement and he begins to experience a holy freedom that is most delightful to his weary self. This is a remarkable description of the process of tshuva. Because it's a process of getting out of Egypt. Right? Before it sounded like, I did something wrong, I feel bad about it, I won't do it. Oh no, if that's what you're doing, you're not going to get anywhere. But you have to realize that sin is an enslavement. Why is it an enslavement? You know? If I spoke slanderously about another person, what does it mean that I have basically enslaved myself? This is a very, very important idea in Judaism. It says in Pirkei Avot that only a person who studies Torah is truly free. And they say this kind of reflecting upon a verse that when Moses came with the tablets, it says in the verse, and the words were engraved on the tablets. The word for engraved is charut. But the rabbis do a play on words and say, don't read charut, but cherut. That the words are freedom on the tablets. The word cherut is freedom. And then they say this interesting idea that there's only the only freedom is Torah. Now that seems to be a shock for a lot of people. Because there's this feeling of, oh well, mitzvot is some form of slavery. I'm going to be God's servant. Okay, great. I remember when Sharansky got out of Russia, it was horrible, you know, but there was an article in one of the Israeli newspapers that said, now that Sharansky has successfully freed himself from the imprisonment of Russia, will he be able to free himself from the imprisonment of religious Judaism? That's what they said, because everybody knew his wife was religious, right? Covers the hair, the whole thing. And now he's coming back to his wife, and they already anticipated, oh, the religious, the frummies, I got to get on his case. Does he have the ability to free himself from that kind of enslavement? Because there's a sense that, you know, Torah, mitzvot, halakha is a form of enslavement. And yet, it's just the opposite Judaism claims. Enslavement. What does it mean to be free? To be free. What is it? Janis Joplin said, freedom is just another word for nothing left to do.
Nothing left to lose.
Is that really freedom? Is that really freedom? Freedom is the opportunity to be who you are. The opportunity to be who you are. That's what freedom is. And there are two forms of freedom. There's something called freedom from and freedom to. When I got out of Egypt, it was freedom from Egypt. But freedom to do what? To be what? To become what? So getting out of Egypt, Passover is the celebration of freedom from enslavement. And Shavuot, the getting of Torah at Sinai, is the freedom to be who I can be. That's ultimate freedom. Judaism sees a sin as a violation of who I am. Who I am. I'm behaving in a manner which is not befitting me. And that's what hurts so much. I'm behaving in a manner that is not expressive of who I really am. And everybody knows how painful that is when you... I mean, it's not like you have any particular commitments. You're free to go here, you're free to go there. Your parents don't say, you got to do this, you got to do that. And sometimes that can be the most painful. It'd be better if you felt, no, I can't do this and I can't do that. Because at least I could blame my slavery on something external. But what happens when all of a sudden all the externalities being totally taken away? My parents say it's okay, you can take off the year. My job says, oh, don't worry, your job will be here. Oh, and you know, and all of a sudden you're so free that you feel so frightened because, but now what am I going to do? There's a fantastic book. I think it's a bit long for its point, but I do think it's a good book by Eric Fromm called Escape from Freedom. And it's all about how people actually run from freedom. Freedom scares people. Because once you're free, you're responsible. And until that point, you could blame everybody else. Well, I did it because my commander told me to do it. I did it because this told me to do it. I have someone else to blame. But freedom is frightening. It really is frightening. Because it's not only freedom from some force that's external to me, where I'm living my life for them, whether it's a cause, or whether it's a person, or whether it's a business, but But to be able to have the confidence, the guts to say, well, who am I? What do I do? And how can I freely express the true me? So Judaism, in a funny way, says that sin is enslavement. What I basically did is enslaved myself to that which is not truly me. If I was really in touch with myself, I'd never say these things. I'd never do these things. Because my true inner self is the image of God. And that's a basic point in Judaism. Freedom is the freedom to be godly. And until I have found some format, some forum, some art form for expressing my godliness, I'm enslaved. I'm not truly a free person. And therefore, what really was the first sin? What was God? What did God say to the first man after the sin? He said, "Where are you?" And that was what hurt. That was what hurt. I mean, you know, after the first man and woman sinned, so they felt uncomfortable with themselves. They felt embarrassed. There's a natural embarrassment that comes with it, which we'll talk about. And so they ran, they're hiding, and all of a sudden God says, "Where are you?" And this is not Ali Ali Oxenfree, "Come on out, where are you? I can't find you." Right? Because certainly Hashem knows exactly where you are. What's frightening is, the statement is, do you know where you are? What happened to you? What, you're frightened of me? Is that what you're frightened of me? You're afraid that I'm going to punish you? Oh, no, no, you should be much, much more frightened of how much you're going to punish you for what you did. And this is a phenomenal idea in Judaism that says that the transgression is its own punishment. And until you fear that, you're not even ready to realize what you really did. And so this notion of that slowly you're coming out of it and you're liberated from the sinful enslavement. It's an enslavement. I wasn't true to my inner self. I wasn't true to my potential. I wasn't true to the image of God that I've been created in. And I just let some other voice take over. I let some other interest take over. And then what happens is, and he begins to experience holy freedom. When you do tshuva, you just feel like everything starts to just open up. You feel a freedom. You feel an opening. And that is most delightful to his weary self. Why is he calling it a weary self? You know, in Koheles and in other places, transgression is referred to as exhausting. Literally tiresome. When Esav walked in and Jacob was cooking up the stew, Esav says, "Give me that red, red stuff because I am tired. Pour that red stuff down my throat because I am tired." And for those of you who are with us, we asked, well, shouldn't he have said, "I am hungry"? Why say, "I am tired"? So the oral tradition says that day he committed five crimes, horrible crimes. And that's why he's tired. What, Esav's tired? I mean, Esav is a Marlboro man. I mean, he's out there, he's fighting, he's tired all of a sudden. He's so tired that he can't, you know, pick up the spoon. No, he's exhausted. What's exhausting? You know, there's different things that really make you tired. Oh, today I had to lift 15 tables. Today I had to clean 100 soup spoons. Oh, today I had to wash the floor. That's tiring, you know. My back hurts. My shoulders hurt. All right, fine. Something more tiring than that. What's really tiring and so exhausting is when I'm spending my days doing something that has nothing to do with who I am. And that really exhausts you. I mean, it might not be physically difficult, but spiritually you feel so imprisoned. You know, it's like, imagine if you know inside yourself that you have the potential, right, to be a doctor, let's say, and yet all you're doing all day long is washing dishes. Now, it might not be physically difficult. It might even pay well. But at night, you are so wiped out because you just feel that you're not able to be who you are. And that's really exhausting. That's so tiresome. And so, Rav Kook tells us that sin is some form of enslavement to a kind of persona, to a role that isn't really me. I need to free myself so I can live a lifestyle that really is an expression of myself, because until I do that, I will always, always feel very tired. You know, I tell you, I feel, you might not feel, I feel I was born to teach. Sounds pretty haughty. What can I say? I love to teach. I just love to teach. You guys can go to sleep, doesn't matter. I love to teach. What can I say? And when I'm teaching, I got an energy that comes from the other world. The other world. I could be sick. At the moment I'm teaching, I don't feel sick. Right? When I'm teaching, I just so plug into what I feel. It's so much the essence of my soul. But you know what? I feel really exhausted when I got to do like paperwork, and when I got to deal with this and that, and I have to deal with discussions dealing with, you know, like how much can we spend on Israelites, this, that. That stuff wipes me out. It's easy. I mean, the truth is, for my mind to make these kind of decisions is much easier than somehow trying to grapple with the most profound issues of life. Ah, man, for me to grapple with the profound issues of life gives me energy, right? And the more difficult it is, the more energy I get from it, right? But I get so wiped out when I have to deal with like really stupid, petty things. That wipes me out. That's the way it is. That's what really exhausts us. We know we've come into this world to do something. Every single person in this world knows they've got some kind of mission. And it's absolutely exhausting not to know what it is.
Right.
And when you're doing it, you know it's it because you have somehow plugged into energy which is just not your own. Right? Not your own. And so, Rav Kook has given us a very poetic, a very colorful, and I feel a real meaningful sense of the process of tshuva. Let's go on. Look, basic idea in Judaism, which is probably the most fascinating concept in the history of mankind. That Judaism came out and said that human beings are created in the image of God. That itself is outrageous. The implications of that is awesome. Put it back into the time of history that it's emerging. It's totally beyond genius. It only could be called a revelation, I think. What other words can we call it? It's a remarkable feeling of such confidence, such belief in the uniqueness. I mean, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? It means a lot of things, but one thing it certainly means is that just as Judaism believes that God is the most unique, you are the most unique. Every single person's room is so absolutely unique. That's a reflection of God. And when you don't have the guts, the courage, the belief in yourself to say, I've got to be who I am. I've got to find out who I am. And to me, part of who I was a Jew. And until I was ready to say it, do it, live it, I really was trapped. Because I knew I was. I knew I was a Jew. And I don't know, I knew I was a Jew, like I knew I had red hair. And I didn't know what that means. I don't know what it means to have red hair. But one thing I knew is there is no historical record of a large group of redheads being, you know, oppressed by virtue of their red hair. I mean, it's not like when you're growing up as a redhead, you don't feel a little oppressed. You do, right? Lots of things come with red hair, okay? But to say I'm Jewish, you know, you can't just like say that and say, pass me the beer. It's just, this, you know, this is a very serious thing to say. It's part of who I am. It might not be everything who I am, right? But it's part of who I am. And I just felt so good the first time I put on my kippah. I was frightened. I'm telling you, I was so frightened. And yet inside myself, I felt so good to say I'm Jewish. And you know, I had to say it in a very difficult situation to a group of Jews. Right? That's much more difficult because I was in high school when I did this. And it was a high school that was 95% Jewish. It was not a Jewish high school. It just happened to be, we lived in a self-imposed Jewish ghetto in Toronto. And 95% of the school was Jewish. And, you know, we liked being Jewish because we got Christmas holidays, we got Hanukkah holidays. You know, we took off whatever we could. It was great, right? The whole school went off because it was a Jewish holiday. But when I decided that, you know, I really want to say I'm Jewish and not be embarrassed about saying I'm Jewish, and I want to put on a kippah. And when I walked into my school that day, boy, did people get angry at me. They got so angry at me. People started swearing at me. Jews, you know. And you have to understand that when I did this, I had this huge afro. You know, it wasn't like you could miss me in school. It wasn't like, I mean, I took up the whole hallway. I walked down, gee, here comes David Aaron. Watch out. So it's one thing to have an afro, another thing to have a red afro, and then to put on it this flying saucer, you know, that's hovering in midair. You know, that's really serious. That's really serious. So I walked in there looking like I was wearing a strimal, you know. I mean, that's what it looks like. And it was really, and I didn't believe what happened. I was very shocked. How angry Jews got at me. And how vicious they became. And how many of my friends didn't want to even address it, as if they didn't even notice this thing on my head. I was shocked by the reaction. And then I was equally shocked, and maybe even more shocked, by the reaction of about 5% of the school, which was Italian. And you know, and these guys, when I walked into school wearing my kippah, it was a total different thing. All of a sudden, you know, they said, hey! Check this guy out. He's cool paisano. Like all of a sudden, I'm a cool paisano because I'm wearing this kippah. See, they have absolutely, or they had, that group anyways, had no problems walking around school with their open hairy chest with some dead half-naked Jew hanging on their chest. And they go like this, hey, Tony, what's happening? Yeah, man. You know, they were fine with that. And like, I'm embarrassed to put on a kippah. Right? They're free. They believe. They walk around with it, and then they're not comfortable with it. You know, it's wild. It's really wild. But like, all of a sudden, we're uncomfortable with it. I remember I had a student who, to put on a kippah, was such a major, major trauma for him, that he came to me one day and he says, you know what I did today? I did it. I put a kippah on my head, and I walked down the street for 2 hours. I walked into town, and you know what happened? I felt okay. I mean, this is real serious stuff. This is a lack of respect for who we are. And so we're slaves. What, I'm afraid what someone's going to say because I wear a kippah on my head? I mean, that's it. I'm a slave. I'm afraid that my friends are going to know that I'm learning Judaism. I mean, yeah, but don't tell my friends because they'll think I'm weird. Right? What am I afraid of? That is enslavement on the highest level. And so Judaism starts off with some very serious assumptions. It assumes that you create the image of God. It assumes that you are extremely unique. It assumes that there are different kinds of people in the world with different kinds of roles. And until they're ready to have the confidence and the courage to say, this is who I am and I'm going to do it, right? They're just going to be weary. They're just going to be really tired. And they're not going to get what they really could be getting out of being who they really are. So it's not simple. It really isn't simple. Because it's not as if I couldn't be doing Shabbos on the level of enslavement also. You know? And I have to get to a point where I'm not keeping Shabbos. I'm being Shabbos. Because Shabbos is my being. You know? I'm celebrating who I am and where I am and why I am. How could I not keep Shabbos? You know, it just gets to that point. And so, I tell you, years ago, there was, nowadays, you know, everyone heard of these sandals called Birkenstocks? Most people heard of it, right there. So years ago, only hippies wore them. You know, now I was in yeshiva and I saw these Birkenstocks. I saw people wearing them and I liked them. I liked the way they look. I knew nothing about them. And I said, you know, when I get to Toronto, I'd like to get a pair of these Birkenstocks, these sandals. Okay, so I find out that you can't buy these shoes in a normal store. But like, I went looking and looking. I find out that there's this boutique in this place, Hippieville, Toronto area. And I go into this place, and it's this tiny store with lots of incense burning, which made sense for a shoe store. I thought, okay, it's a shoe store. Why? I've never been to a shoe store with so much, Indian kind of incense. And then I see little hookahs, and I thought, this is a really weird place. And I said, I think I've made a mistake. I'm looking for a place that sells Birkenstock sandals. He says, oh, that's us. They're right over here. And he takes me through the store, and they had one shelf. Can you imagine? Not so long ago, that in Toronto there was one shelf of Birkenstock. Now you've had Birkenstock centers. And okay, fine. So he says to me, do you know what these shoes are all about? I said, no, I don't. I just like the way they look. Could you just get me a size 7? He said, no. You must really understand how these shoes are your soulmate. I say, yeah. Are you trying to, up the price? Because I'm telling you right now, I want the shoes already. I don't need the sale. He says, no, you have to understand. He shows me a picture of a footprint of a foot in sand. He says, that was our natural foot. That was our original foot. That was our foot before we were in this world of pavement and concrete. That was our foot. All of a sudden, I started admiring feet. Our foot. Wow. Our foot. He says, now you have an opportunity to go back to your natural foot. I can't? Really? He says, yes, with these Birkenstocks. You see these gentle bumps within them? I look, oh, you mean, isn't this a defective pair? No. This is the sand. These are the natural contours. Wait until you wear these shoes. It's going to be you. It's going to be you. I'm looking at this guy like, how much do you think he smokes before he sells these things? You know what I mean? So he says, but I have to warn you. Those shoes you're wearing now are good for killing cockroaches in a corner. But they're not your foot. And so it's going to take you a while to get back in touch with your natural foot. And I'm looking at this like, I've never bought shoes like this. I mean, So I put them on. I say, they don't fit. He says, I told you. You see, your foot is no longer natural. Right? And this shoe is natural. So it's going to take you a while. And so I warn you, please, when you buy these shoes, wear them only 1 hour the first day. And then 2 hours the second day. 3 hours the third day, you'll be sailing. You'll never feel better with a pair of shoes. I thought, what a salesman. I tell you, it was great. Anyways, I bought the shoes, I put them on, couldn't care less what he said, and I started walking home. And they felt a little strange, and I thought it was really weird because there were definitely bumps in the bottom of these shoes. Well, about 2 hours go by, and the discomfort turns into excruciating pain. I mean, I had never in my life experienced. I had pain shooting up my spine, and I said, "The guy, what a con artist! He ripped me off royally, and now I got these stupid shoes with bumps in them. Natural schmatural. I'm going to take these shoes back." I come back the next day and say, I told you these shoes don't fit. There's something wrong. Maybe with a hammer you can knock down some of these bumps. He says, did you wear them longer than an hour? I went, yes, sir. I did. He said, I told you, to get back to your natural sense is going to take time. But I promise you it'll never feel the same. And I want you to know that he was right. And I want you to know that we're selling them on sale, Israelite Birkenstocks, for only $9.99. In other words, to get in touch with your natural self might feel a little unnatural in the beginning. But there's a point where you feel it's a fit. You really feel it's a fit. And it gives you a tremendous amount of energy. It really does. But it does take time, and it does take pain, and it does take patience. And it takes the courage to experiment and say, yeah, I'll put on my kippah for a couple of days. What's the worst that could happen? Yeah, I'll try and put on these tefillin. Yeah, I'll try and dress modestly. Yeah, I mean, try. What do I got to lose? Right? What do I got to lose? And so there's a weariness that Judaism claims comes from just not being who I am, not expressing my potential, not facilitating what I could facilitate in the world. His healing continues. And here's another fascinating word. All of a sudden, tshuva's healing. You know, before I thought I did it, I feel bad about it, I won't do it again. No, no, then you didn't do it. It's healing. I feel... So what is disease? Because at this point, and the Talmud says that a transgression is like is a disease. Creates disease. A disease is dis-ease. That's what a disease is. Right? I am not harmonious with the total reality. That's what happens. That's what a dis-ease is. I'm not in sync with the movement of life. And Judaism claims that the mitzvot are very much like footsteps on the dance floor. And the dance is there, but how do you get into the dance? How do you get into the dance of life? So in the beginning it feels a little, you know, one, two, three, four, you feel like a klutz, right? Okay, fine. But once you get it, in the beginning dance is so incredibly rigid. I mean, you come to dance and they're telling you to follow these things painted on the floor with numbers on it. You feel stupid. Right? It's like I mentioned to someone today, it's like looking at music. It looks like the absolute opposite of music. Everything music means to me, and all of a sudden show me, and this is sheet music. You say, that's music? That looks so rigid. That looks so mechanical. That looks so mathematical. It looks so scientific. It doesn't look like music and the harmony and the movement and the flow and the... I don't see it. Well, that's the problem that people have when they look at Jewish law. They're like people who don't know music looking at sheet music and never having the ability to see how this can translate into an incredible dance of life. And so, when I'm not in sync with myself, I'm not in sync with reality, Hashem, then I feel I go into a state of dis-ease. And tshuva is healing. Right? I get back into the flowingness of life. Now I know all this sounds so kind of foreign because it's very hard for people to think that halakha, Jewish life, could be flowingness. Right? But it really can be when you become somewhat of a master. And that takes time. His healing continues. Rays of benign sun bearing divine mercy reach out to him and a feeling of happiness grows within. I mean, this is such a precious, you know, description of tshuva, which is rare to find. A description, an emotional, experiential description of tshuva, rather than you do this, you do that, you do this. What is he saying over here? What happens is during the healing, something reaches out to me. You remember I told you the Talmud that says that all Hashem asks of us is to open our hearts. Just a pinhole. And then God will do the rest. I don't do this process alone. Nobody asks you to do tshuva on your own. It's really not the Jewish ideal. But so to speak, God accompanies me on this journey. But I have to be willing to let God take this trip with me. And that's opening my heart a little bit. Opening my heart a little bit, I don't know, maybe it means just getting over the conceited feeling that nobody can help me. Nobody can help me. And I really feel that the 12 steps have been so successful because the first step is knowing I'm not alone. And so something happens. All I have to do is make the first step. And this light of kindness, he says, comes showering down on me, bearing divine mercy, reaching out to me, and a feeling of happiness grows within. What is this feeling of happiness? I think the feeling of happiness is the realization that I can change. And I think that's one of the most happiest things that people could experience, is I'm not locked, I'm not imprisoned, I'm not lost, I'm not enslaved, but I'm alive. I'm really alive, and I'm not alone, which I think is the hardest thing. Now remember, we mentioned the other day how happiness isn't a goal, it's a side effect. It's a side effect. And this is the way he's depicted. Something starts to grow inside. but it's inside. It's not happiness from outside. If I'm expecting to be happy from things outside, I can expect a long time. If my happiness is so dependent upon external acknowledgments or external situations, and I've seen this in Rav Kook before, happiness is really when you are who you are. When you're really who you are, you're really so happy. You know? And you hate yourself when you're fake. And sometimes you might not be so clear to say I hate myself, but when you feel like you're really a fake, I don't think there's anything more painful than that. You know? And so when I'm really opening up and I'm really acknowledging and I'm not denying, and I'm feeling the pain, I'm not afraid to feel the pain, and I start to let that inner soul inside me go and move forward, then a ray of kind light comes down upon me. And I feel help. He experiences this at the same time that his heart remains broken and his spirit bowed in melancholy. Now here's a fantastic line. He just tells me that I'm going to feel happy, and now he says, and by the way, simultaneously, you're still going to feel broken, bowed, and melancholy. Now, is it possible to be both happy and sad? The truth is, that's the happiest moments. Because it's like a picture. The brilliance of it is the contrast. Right? I don't know if people want to be just happy. I think they want to be in the cutting edge. With a really tasty where the world of sadness and the world of happiness meet, that's where life is so real. And that's where so much is really happening. And you know, I'm not so quick to let go of my sadness. People say, oh, yeah, gee, you know, I want to be happy. It's like music. Sound is silence and sound. Color is darkness and light. Right? Dance is up and down. And it all happens right there on the cutting edge of the transition. And that's a very important moment. So a person shouldn't have these expectations that, oh, they're going to be dancing out of their seat. They're going to have a very wonderful and yet very strange paradoxical sense of both great happiness and great sadness. And the interesting thing is, you're not going to want to let go of that sadness. Because you learned so much in that sadness. And you gained so much in that sadness. And it might have been some of the most fulfilling moments, that sadness. How so? Let's go on. Indeed, this lowly feeling itself, which suits him in his condition, adds to his spiritual satisfaction and his sense of true peace. It's an amazing thing to say. Indeed, this lowly feeling, I've been feeling so low. I've been feeling such a low life that I did these kind of things. And having that feeling, and that feeling becomes even enhanced by this contrast feeling of the ability to grow out of it and the ability to get beyond that and the ability to change, all of a sudden, there's a spiritual satisfaction in his sense of true peace. Where's this peace? He just described the paradox. There's happiness growing with a simultaneous sadness. Where's the peace? I think the peace is the humanness of the moment. And I think that is some of our most difficult challenges, is to accept our humanness. We're human. We're sometimes up and we are sometimes down. And we're sometimes good and we're sometimes bad. And the ability to be on top of that is a real peaceful moment of accepting who I am and knowing that who I am is precisely a movement that swings. Maybe it doesn't have to be dramatic swings. Maybe it doesn't have to be extreme. Hopefully it wouldn't. But yeah, I'm alive and I'm struggling. Because life is a struggle. It really is a struggle. It can be a great struggle. It's like when you're playing a good game of hockey, it's precisely the possibility that you could lose that makes it a fantastic game. And sometimes you win so much by losing. You win so much by losing. And so sometimes you realize that it's good to lose sometimes. And it's certainly important to know that I can lose. Because if I could never lose, it would be a horrible experience. And yet if I could only lose, it would be a horrible experience. But if I know how to dance the life of winning and losing, losing yet winning, then I'm real. Then I'm growing. And I'm being fully human. And so, I think that's the paradox, and yet that's the joy. There's a certain peacefulness in the struggle. There's a certain peacefulness in these two vectors going off in different directions. But that's okay. Because that is my life. And that is who I am. So it's important to understand how in Judaism, tshuva is a natural part of life. It's not like, oh gee, what can I do? I made a mistake, I got to do tshuva. You come in this world already knowing you're going to have to do tshuva. It's the theme of life, tshuva. Let's see a little more. He feels himself drawing closer to the source of life, to the living God. Interesting, living God, who but a short time before was so remote from him. Things aren't plastic anymore. It's so good to cry. It's so good to laugh. I would say some of my most fulfilling moments is when I've cried. Why? And you know, it's so funny, people cry at weddings. It's your happiest moment. People cry at funerals. It's your saddest moment. Why is it the same reaction? Because what's so special about the happiest moments and the saddest moments? You feel so real. You feel this isn't a film. You feel this isn't some little play. You feel like, wow, I'm alive. And I have emotions. And it's a great feeling. But what happens to people is they become very plastic. They become very plastic, I'm in love. There's a kind of plastic love. There's a kind of plastic sadness. It's not really touching my core. And I've just become so desensitized because I've said the word love so much and I've said the word depressed so much that I'm not coming close to the living God. And so, he says, to the living God who but a short time before was so remote from him. So remote from him. The ability to just like that. Feel so far and yet feel so close. When you really love somebody, it can have that kind of drama. And I don't know if I ever mentioned to you, Kirk Douglas once said to me that what he loves about being Jewish is it's dramatic. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, you know what drama is? Drama is sharp contrasts. And then I had the opportunity for him to do a little drama for me. He said, see, look, let's say we're playing a scene and the person's going to get a letter that their mother passed away. So what's the scene? The guy's sitting there eating, all of a sudden they pass him a letter and say, oh my mother passed away, right? He says, no. Drama is the person's laughing. They're in the middle of a party. Right? They're not sitting there at their desk studying or listening to, you know, some sad movie or whatever. But no. They're at a party. And they're really happy. And then someone comes up to them and say, excuse me, this is for you. And you say, oh, great. And you're smiling, open up. Oh, look, it's her. My gosh. My mother passed away. That's drama. People love drama. People don't just go to shows that are funny and happy. Right? People like movies that have sadness and happiness. Because people love life. And life is a drama. And life as a drama are in fact these contrasts, which are so exciting, which is tshuva, which is coming from this place to that place. And the energy is right in the middle of that. Right in the middle of that. So it's really very... And so, a short moment, I was so far from God. And now I'm so close to God. It's so dramatic. Right? It's so dramatic. His wistful spirit recalls with joyous relief its previous inner anguish. And is filled with a feeling of gratitude. What do you mean? You recall the joyous relief of your previous inner anguish? You feel happy you were sad. You feel happy you were in pain. Because you know if you weren't in pain, you wouldn't be able to feel this either. And so you're not going to expect to feel, you know. I mean, people have such, sometimes their vision of life is so boring, you know. They'll have a job, a couple kids, a car, a dog, a house, a white picket fence. And everything's going to go so smooth. Yeah, but when it goes smooth, do you feel the ride? You want to feel the ride. Because it's just the ride. It's the journey itself. Right? If nothing's moving, if nothing's going, if there's no ups, there's no downs, a little roller coaster to my life. What gets my adrenaline moving? And so there's actually a joyous relief. A joyous relief in its previous inner anguish. And I'm filled with a certain gratitude. A gratitude for the possibility to sin. Now, this is really remarkable. Because, you know, life begins with sin. And I know it's going to sound really not so rabbinical to say it. But it's biblical to say it. Because the first man in the garden, there he was. Everything was wonderful. Ah, great. Everything was wonderful. You know? But God puts in the garden a dilemma. Now it's a little more interesting. A tree of knowledge of good and bad. That sounds attractive. Well, now God certainly could have put it in the corner somewhere, behind a couple of, you know, bushes. No. God wants to put it right in the center. And then, not only has God put this tree that I'm not supposed to touch in the center, right? But he creates this little snake that goes around saying, touch it, touch it, touch it, touch it, touch it. And you start to wonder, hey, what's really going on over here? What's really going on over here? I don't want my kid to touch my stereo. I put it in the living room, in the center of the living room. I create a little brother that goes around saying, touch it, touch it, touch it. Right? And all this is happening on the sixth day of creation. You should know that the sin of the first man and woman happened on the sixth day of creation. It was part of his creation. Because until you make a choice, until you have tasted the meaning of dilemma, and had the courage to make a choice, you are not yet in the image of God. You are not yet alive. You have not yet tasted the drama of life. And God, to create a human being, had to create an opportunity for that human being to create themselves. To be challenged. To be disturbed. And whatever the choice would have been, it would be better than no choice at all. Because then you're really not alive. And so how did life begin? When did it really begin for man? When he sinned. And the Midrash says that the first man turns to God and says, wait a second, wait a second. Ha ha, I'm thinking about this. This is, I know what's going on. This was a setup. You set me up. That's what the Midrash says. He turns to God and says, you set me up. He says, this is analogous to a husband who walked into his home with a divorce document in his back pocket. He asks his wife, could you please pour me a drink? She pours him a drink. He says, yuck. This is lukewarm. Here, you're divorced. She looks at him. She says, what are you talking about? You had that divorce document in your back pocket, and you knew totally well that this was going to be a lukewarm drink. This is a setup. And that's what the first man says to God. You set me up. You put the tree there. You put the snake there. You set me up. And you know what God answers? He doesn't. And that's the most dramatic part of this midrash. He doesn't say yes, and he doesn't say no. And he doesn't say no, and he doesn't say yes. And I think part of it is because you're asking the wrong question. It's not whether you set it up. It's, why did you set this up? Because if you'd ask, why did you set this up? You'd understand, until you made a move, you weren't really alive. You weren't accessing the holiness of the freedom that I've invested in you. And I wanted you to taste freedom. The freedom to say yes, the freedom to say no. You know what the real sin of the first man was? It was that he didn't do tshuva, but he denied his sin. Because that's the real sin of sins. Because Judaism believes we are human and we make mistakes and we try and we make mistakes. And I'm standing Yom Kippur and I'm saying to God, I don't want to do Lashon Hara, but I know I said that last year, the year before, and I'm probably going to say it next year too. So why say it again? Because it means something right now. Because I need to always get in touch with that freedom. And I should try. And know that I'll try and I'll fail, but I'll try. But that's okay, I'm human. But when I stop trying and don't take the journey, I'm dead. So the real sin wasn't so much the eating of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. That we could deal with. But when God said to him, where are you? And he said, she did it. And then God says to the woman, where are you? And she says, snake did it. And everybody's passing the buck. She's not alive. Life is responsibility. And if you can't be responsible about what you do, then you're as good as dead. What are we? And so there's this joyous relief in the inner anguish, and I'm filled with gratitude. What's my gratitude? It breaks into a hymn of thanksgiving. Praise the Lord, O my soul. Forget not all His kindness. He forgives all your sins. He heals all your afflictions. He rescues your life from the pit. He adorns you with grace and compassion. He satiates you with every good. He renews your youth like an eagle. The Lord performs merciful acts. He vindicates the cause of the oppressed. You say, what an awesome opportunity to get to know you. It's so special when you get the chance for the one that loves you to forgive you. Your relationship's never going to be the same. The opportunity to sin, and the opportunity to feel the pain, and the opportunity to say, I don't want to go on, and the courage to say, I'm sorry, is so full of life. And then the joy to hear my beloved say, I forgive you. Would I have wanted to give up that opportunity? When I wanted to give up that opportunity, the opportunity to hear someone who I love say to me, which is such a demonstration of love, I forgive you. And so it's almost as if saying that when I get married, I'm hoping somehow I'm going to make a mistake so that I'll have this high opportunity to feel the pain of this mistake. Value the relationship in a way I never would have valued had I felt so far, and have the opportunity to see you with such eyes of love and compassion, Sam, I forgive you. What a silly thing. Love means never having to say I'm sorry. Gee, if I didn't know how to say I'm sorry, I don't know where I'd be right now. Love and life means learning how to say you're sorry. And if you can't learn to say you're sorry, you're really sorry. You're really sorry. And it's such a fantastic thing to be able to say, I'm sorry. But I mean, when you really feel the pain, and you denied it, and you were embarrassed, but you finally hit it, and you finally said, I'm really sorry. And the joy to hear that person say, and I forgive you. I mean, that's such a life experience. Would you want to miss it? That's the irony of Judaism. You have a mitzvah to do tshuva. Well, that's kind of funny because in order to do this mitzvah, I have to sin. We won't tell you that. right? But just know you're going to, right? It's going to happen. It's part of life. That doesn't mean, oh good, I'm sinning, and say, hey, it's part of life. No, it's part of life. Life is the drama in the transition from the pain to the joy, from the hurt to the ecstasy, from the feeling so far to the feeling of being so close. That's where it's happening. And so I remember I saw a news clipping of a fellow who had been imprisoned. The government had accused him of treason. It was this young guy, a religious kid. I mean, it seemed like the sweetest guy. And for months he was in jail, and it was this long trial, and da-da-da. And finally, after months of this struggle, you know, he's free. He's acquitted. He's innocent. I tell you, the joy in that guy's face. I said to myself, gee, I wonder if he has that joy when he gets up in the morning. I mean, isn't it kind of funny? Was it worth all that pain to feel all that joy? And so that's really where it's happening. It's right in the middle of that. That's tshuva. It's the transition. How anguished the soul was when the burden of sin, it's a burden, it's dark, vulgar, frightfully oppressive weight lay upon her. Right? That the soul is in anguish. The soul is in anguish. How depressed she was. Even if outer riches and honors fell to her lot, what good is there in all the wealth if the inner content of life is impoverished and dry? What's the content of your life? I mean, people are just such experts at everything around it. Do you have substance? I mean, what's really the substance? I don't know if I ever told you this story. Probably did. Sorry. But I was fundraising in the States. And, this person said they would host a parlor meeting at their home. I'll save you for the first part, it's not so important, but she was very obnoxious, and I was shocked that she even offered this because she was being so obnoxious. We were having lunch, and she says, well, Rabbi, what do you do? I took out the brochure of Israelite, and I gave it to her. She held it like a piece of toilet paper. She said, Rabbi, I see so many of these. Just tell me what it is, and I'll write the check. Right? Meaning, you're such a jerk, Rabbi. Your thing is so worthless. You're just another, you know. And I said, okay. So I started to tell her what I do. And before I even really get to tell her what I do, she already takes out her check and starts writing a check. And there's two other people at the lunch, and she says, I don't know why I'm doing this. And she writes me this huge check of $18. Right? Okay, fine. Look, you know, the rule in fundraising is you never look at the check. You fold it, you put it in your pocket, you thank them, believing that this is millions of dollars, because really, if that's what they gave, then that's what it is. Okay, so fine. But I felt, oh, this lady's crazy. I mean, she was really so mean. And then I get this call that she's decided to host a parlor meeting for me with all her friends. She's a very wealthy person, very plugged in. I said, wonderful, great. So I get to the place, and there was someone who was taking him around in the city and was being very nice and, you know, introducing me to people. So I get to this place, this huge place, gorgeous place, and the spread was incredible. And they hired waitresses and waiters for this occasion, and like, wow, I was feeling, wow, this is going to be really a successful event. So I give a class on the meaning of education, and, people listen. But of course, I was most interested in the man of this house, you know, the owner, because he was really, you know, I don't know anybody else here, but I know that this guy is a very huge philanthropic fellow. You know, he could really make a difference over here. And so I start giving my class, and the guy sits in front of me, and no sooner than like 2 minutes, he's up, and he walks away and sits at the back of the room. And then another 3 minutes, he's up and he sits over to the left side of the room. And then another 2 minutes, he's standing there. And then, hi, he leaves. And I felt horrible. What did I say wrong? What did I do wrong? I mean, the guy couldn't sit for a minute and listen to what I have to say. Well, okay, at the end of the class, people come up to me, start asking me questions. And this guy in the middle of this circle around me walks in the middle of the circle with a brochure of Israelite with a check sticking out of it and says, here, Rabbi! Right? And he gives me this check in front of everybody. Now, I realized he was being noble. He was trying to start the ball rolling. His friends will see, oh, you know, he gave a check, we'll give a check. But it was absolutely embarrassing, you know? It really was embarrassing. But okay, fine. All right, the evening deteriorated a little more, and they started talking about the new swimming pool. And someone said over to, let's say the guy's name was Joe, which it wasn't, but let's say the guy's name was Joe. I said, Joe, how much did you pay for this new swimming pool? He said, I figured that if I swim in this pool every day for the next 30 years, and basically I figured out that every length I do is equal to about 30 strokes, that I am paying about a buck a stroke. Now, I don't know if he was being funny or if he was being sick or maybe both, but that's what he said. All right, well, so I figured out, you know, what am I going to do? I get in the car, it was pouring rain, get in the car, and we're driving away. As we're driving away, I see this man walk out of his house and start stomping down the street in the rain. And the woman who's driving me around turns to me and she says, what a poor man. I said, I beg your pardon? I mean, this was a castle. She said, poor man, he can't sleep. He can't sit still. Did you see how he couldn't sit still for a moment in your class? He's always like that. I've never seen the man with any tranquility on his face. And did you see him just walk out of his house in the rain without a coat? And I saw this multimillionaire walking down the street in the pouring rain. And I realized, poor man. What a poor man. And so if the inner content of my life does not find the tranquility in the struggle, right? In the struggle. But because it's a meaningful struggle, and it's a beautiful struggle, and it's a dramatic experience of life. Well, everything from without is just never going to satisfy me. It's not going to do it. The Midrash brings a beautiful metaphor that it's like a villager who married the daughter of the king. Anything he brings her will never be enough. And so the Midrash is saying the daughter of the king is the soul. And whenever you bring the soul from this world, she's tasted the palace. She wants much more than that. Okay, what good is there in all the wealth in the inner content life is if the inner content life is impoverished and dry? And how blissful she now is in the inner feeling that her sin has been forgiven. There's a tremendous bliss in being forgiven, right? Even more so than had I never done this before, I get to know you, I get to know me so much more. And therefore, as a phenomenal piece, and I know I'm going over time for myself, but I need to tell you this. This is from Chovot Levavot, The Duties of the Heart. And here he talks about the notion of how the one who does repentance in certain situations is considered to be even beyond the place where a tzaddik, their whole life has been. And he explains like this. A penitent who has committed a minor sin, such as a violation of prohibition, that does not involve the penalty of excision, which is being cut off, which is a real serious sin, and then fully repents with the requisite conditions of repentance, is constantly mindful of his sin. When you do a sin, you're constantly mindful of your sin, and that is an absolute profit. Why? Beseeches forgiveness for its commission, is ashamed before the Creator, his heart penetrated by the fear of the punishment, his soul contrite, always humble before God, his sin having occasioned his humbleness and caused him to endeavor to fulfill his duties to the Creator while he is not in the least proud of aught in his good activity. In other words, there's a benefit to the sin when I do tshuva on it. I get so much mileage out of the sin because I save myself a graver sin, which is haughtiness. The knowledge that I can fail and have failed has tremendous dividends in maintaining a healthy sense of humbleness. And he says that it does not seem great to him that he does not glory in it and is ever watchful throughout the rest of his life. It also gives me a sense of caution. When I make a mistake, I'm more humble and I'm more cautious. And if I got that from it, it was worth it. It was really worth it. All right? Such a sinner has acquired a superiority over a righteous man who has not committed a sin at all. For there is no assurance that the righteous man will not become haughty. See, if you're righteous your whole life, you might become haughty. A person who wasn't righteous their whole life, they are just much more humble, much more cautious with themselves. That his heart will not be uplifted, that he will not feel exalted in his pious activity. It's an old saying, listen to this, that a sin may be more useful A sin may be more useful to one who repents than all the righteous deeds of a righteous man. And there is righteousness which is more injurious to a righteous man than all his sins are to the repenter. Do you hear this? There is a sin which is more advantageous to the sinner than a righteousness which could be dangerous to the righteous man. This is so if the righteous man empties his heart of humility and contracts pride. Right? It's amazing. It's phenomenal. I mean, this is a Jewish attitude. It's so human and it's so beautiful. It's so compassionate to realize that there's so much I can get out of this sin. It's not as if, oh, I really wasted. I can recycle. I tell you, Judaism was the first recycling notion. Nothing's wasted. You can get so much out of this sin. If what you learn from this sin is humbleness, your humanness, you're cautious, you don't have this overconfidence in yourself that, you know, and you save yourself from pride and haughtiness, then it was worth it. It was worth it. And so this is what we're learning over here. He says, how blissful she now is in the inner feeling that her sin is being forgiven. Ah! Had I not sinned and not experienced forgiveness, I don't know if I would have tasted this kind of bliss. That the nearness of God is already alive and shining in her, that her inner burden has made lighter, that she already paid her debt and is no longer pressed by inner confusion and rest. She is at rest and filled with innocent peace. Return to your peace, O my soul, for the Lord has bestowed His kindness on you. This is only the first part of this article. The first part of the article is about attacking particular sins. And he's given us a very descriptive, emotional, experiential sense of the process. So that now that we've become familiar with the process, we can participate in it. And what I believe Rav Kook has given us is a sense of the light at the end of the tunnel. And as long as you keep seeing that light at the end of the tunnel, you'll keep moving forward.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.